Some of you, no doubt, have done courses here, introductions to Buddhism courses, so what I'm about to say will start off to be well known to you. Buddhism, then, in a way, started in India with the life of a particular man in 563 BC. But as we soon come to discover when we read Buddhist literature, this is just a phase of Buddhism. There were previous examples of previous awakened, enlightened people, etc. I just have to treat that as background for now, and we will indeed start with the life of a man who lived in northern India in 563. They've changed it, haven't they? More researchers changed the dates. 6th century BC, anyway. Do we know what Buddha means, the word? Enlightened one, or more prosaically, awakened one. Yeah. I love that, because that implies that it's not necessarily a sort of a phenomenal occurrence, although it was, but it's not just that. It's just waking up. It's just waking up, and that feels a lot more accessible. I can cope with that successive waking up. So, some of you know the story about this man who was born into great affluence, into a princely role, destined to become a king of a particular state of northern India, as it then was, who, when he reached something like the age of 29, rather like we said about the reaction to the Vedas, well, this man reacted to all of the beliefs of his time, to his allocated role in life and everything. And the reason he reacted was he was, on the face of it, leading a sort of perfect life. His lifestyle, he was groomed, so it seems, to just see the bright. He had good health, he had family, he had opulence, he had everything, and it wasn't enough. But to cut a long story short, because it is a long story, he decided to renounce that, and one night left, swapped his gorgeous robes for the rags of a passing beggar, who was quite pleased with the swap, I imagine, shaved his head, and went off into the forest. Now, what's the forest? Wild, into the unknown. With a view to really begin to see things as they really were, not the way he was brought up in his other rose-tinted glasses way to see. And he said he spent 6 years doing that, going from one teacher to another. Reginald Ray is an American Buddhist who's written this book. And he quotes a sutra that talks about the teachers that this, he's not yet the Buddha, Gotama, met during these 6 years of having renounced his rich life, deciding to learn to meditate, to learn to understand, to go past his limited self into what he felt was, if you like, a bigger self, if you like. So he learned and surpassed every teacher he came up to. And he got to the point, after about 6 years, where the theme of his practices, ascetic practices, were self-denial, denying the body. So he'd reached a point of emaciation. He was extremely thin, and in fact, in probably quite poor health. But that wasn't his concern. He wanted to transcend the body state, so he was taught that was the way to do it. But one day he realised it wasn't working, and so he made a decision, to the disgust of his fellow ascetics, to take sustenance, to take some food. It's beginning to come back into a sort of what you might call middle way, opulence, austerity, middle way. And he sat down one night and decided he was going to meditate until he made the breakthrough that he felt was there to be had. And this is the night of his so-called enlightenment. What was this enlightenment that he had? Well, we can't answer that. Even Sangharakshita, who writes books on it, calls it ineffable. Good word there. It's beyond words. It's beyond words. It's something beyond conceptions even. Reginald Ray obviously wasn't listening, because he's written an account of the enlightenment there, which I think is fascinating. Whereas you might have thought that it's like the Buddha's ascetic experiences, leaving the body behind, going into some greater realm of existence. Reginald Ray talks about the enlightenment experience of going deeper into the body. In. Wasn't it you that were saying about, we've used this language already today, haven't we, about going in. But here, the going within was different. What he's suggesting here is that all of our past lives are in some way in our bodies. Can you get hold of that idea? I don't know if you've had this experience as yoga teachers, but have you ever taught somebody a pose and they come out of it absolutely rocked to the roots of their being? Because knowingly or unknowingly, you've touched upon a pose that released something from the body tissues, a trauma, quite often. Can you believe that? I've had it happen, so I know it. I gave a guy in Scotland on retreat once an assisted backbend where you put a yoga brick under your sacrum and you lay back across it, you know, in a sort of bow shape, a backbend. All of a sudden he came out of it and started puffing like a steam train. I thought, what's the matter with this man, you know? He said, I must go outside. And he went outside and he walked around this field about 20 times very fast. I thought, what have I done to him? What have I done to this poor man? And when he came back, he said, thank you so much. He said, I just relived my father's abuse of me. And he said, it's beginning to calm down now and I feel like I've let it out. I can't claim any credit for that. I didn't know that that pose would produce that reaction. And it's sort of been accepted in yoga circles. They call it issues in the tissues, don't they? that your body harbours. Amplify that to not so much a trauma situation now, but a life situation where, if we were able, didn't you mention regression? I don't know if that's an example, but certainly through certain practices we can connect with and release past experiences from our body. Coming back to this, that's what Reginald Ray is saying the enlightenment experience started out to be, where the Buddha, he wasn't yet the Buddha, where Gautama meditated, went into himself, get into the depths more after he'd got 6 years of momentum of these practices behind him here, so this was no ordinary meditation, to connect with an awareness of the many past lives he'd experienced. So begin to connect with what he saw as his interconnection with every sentient being on the planet. On and on it went. This then, according to Reginald Ray's interpretation, was the beginning of his enlightenment experience that just went on during that particular night that gave him this full awakening. And please read the four watches of the night. And to repeat, he didn't do it by leaving his body behind, he did the opposite, according to Reginald Ray. He went into his body with his deep awareness. Pause on story. What do you think? Make sense?
That's one of the most interesting things I've found so far myself in coming into meditation and a bit of Buddhism. It's coming from a yoga perspective. I didn't expect meditation to suggest to me that I come into my body in order to find it. And I'm so pleased because I've got this 10 years of experience in my own body, but I just that really is great, but that's not what I thought.
Well, if you had come 20 years ago, you would be taught the mindfulness of breathing, and if you said, oh, and by the way, I felt such and such while I was doing it, the instructor, her particular instructor, would say, don't take any notice of that, get back to the breath. Mm. I think that was just early days, so they got it. Mm. The way that you're now taught to meditate is like a precursor based on the same lines as that experience. So, permission, in fact encouragement, to do more of that and listen to your body. And if a pose, like my one with the legs, that was actually rooted in a past pain, but sometimes, do you have poses that you really don't want to go there? Mm-hmm. You can't attribute a physical reason to it sometimes, but you really don't want to go there. I did have a guy who we did half moon pose, where you just stand on one leg and you're really open in the heart centre. And he came down and started crying. He said, I'm sorry, my dad died last week. And it just put me in touch with that grief because of the open-heartedness. He was feeling quite pleased in a way that it's part of the grieving process for him and was releasing it. So, issues in the tissues. Deep, set, physical harbouring of past events, which in those terms is you in your personal life, but in bigger terms, on the bigger stage, if you like, is really an explanation, according to Reggie. I like calling him Reggie because he's such a serious academic, but I think he's serious with Reggie. According to him, is the possible pattern of that enlightenment experience. So it's encouraging for us to go down a similar path. Yeah?
It's a bit of a contradiction sometimes, though, because actually we try, in again, there's a meditation saying, you know, your ego is very tied up maybe in how you feel about yourself physically and what your body looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, we're saying, don't fight the aging process, go with it. And then we're saying that your body's so important.
Right,
watch it,
right,
observe
right,
it,
right,
like,
right,
you know,
right.
Just...
Mm.
Yeah, it teaches you things.
It teaches you, yes.
Mm, yeah.
That's the interesting thing. It could be your teacher. Is your teacher.
Mm.
Paramananda writes about, well, finding the middle way in the body, not going to the extreme of overvaluing it or just negating it.
So, main point made there, I think. Moving on from that, we can start to look at, briefly, at the development of Buddhism with a mind always to see what connections we can make with our yoga practice. And I think there are loads. We've just done one, haven't we? The body being your teacher. Ray uses the word full embodiment, implying that perhaps we're not fully into our bodies. We perhaps hold some of it at a distance. We're not absolutely dwelling in it. We're not fully inhabiting our body. We hold back, knowing it down to its depths, if you like. Right, so Buddhism, that was 2,500 years ago. It's said to have developed into three stages or yanas, vehicles yana, since that time. And each of those yanas offers us a slightly different perspective and a whole set of different practices. So I just wanted to briefly go through them to see these practices and how they relate to yoga. The first 500 is not as clear-cut as this, they are all in there together, but the dominant one for the first 500 years is called the Hinayana. It wasn't called that at the time, because that means lesser vehicle, and they didn't think that at the time. Only later people at back end called it that. And you could say that the hallmark of that phase was just your liberation from your limited state to an enlightened state. And the main list, a threefold list. Does anybody know of the threefold way? Ethics, meditation, wisdom, in that order. Compare those to Patanjali's eight limbs when you get a chance. See if you can see where those three elements correlate to the eight elements. Yama, niyama, very much about ethics. Asana, pranayama,
prachahara,
probably all the way down to number seven to do with meditation and eight to do with wisdom. In the 90s, we few Buddhist yogis used to go a couple of times a year to the Manchester Buddhist Centre to meet like-minded others. Sounds like some secret cult, isn't it? To the yoga studio, Bodywise, at Manchester, and we'd explore all this. And you'd be amazed looking back on it how tentative we were to make these connections, as if it was heresy. The climate's changed enormously, it really has. Anyway, Hinayana then very much is involved with the threefold way of ethics, meditation and wisdom. And the practices that they employed there, well, we did one, we did the mindfulness of breathing. That was a major practice. I've got a handout for you afterwards to read at home about how that's actually a 16-stage meditation, not a 4. And walking meditation. What's missing? What did the later people say? This is a lesser vehicle because it doesn't promote. So far, the story, I'm exaggerating just to make the distinctions, is about self-liberation. The Buddha taught self-liberation, but if you read between the lines or really look into what he taught, he was telling you to, you know, be other-regarding as well as self-regarding. And this first vehicle doesn't seem to emphasize that enough. So the Mahayana, the greater vehicle, added compassion into it as a major feature. It incorporated everything that went before, but added a much greater emphasis on compassion. And so, amongst many other things, we've got a set of meditations called the Metta Bhavana. Metta being, if you like, unconditional love. What happens when unconditional love meets suffering? You get the Karuna Bhavana. Karuna meaning compassion. what happens when metta meets happiness? Mudita bhavana, sympathetic joy, you're happy at their happiness. And then if you practice all three and you're getting good at it, you come to an equanimity, upeksha bhavana. So there's a whole set of practices there that are very much other regarding, developing warmth, compassion, sympathetic joy in as regards others.
And those are referenced in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras as well, aren't they?
Yeah, that's it. So look how it's beginning to come nicely together. But do disagree with me, won't you, if you think I'm forcing these things together. Now, this comes the good bit. Here we are, 1,000 years perhaps after the death of the Buddha. Buddhism spread by now, much more into, in particular, into Tibet. And there's a figure in the 8th century who is sometimes regarded as the second Buddha. Have you ever come across this figure? There's a figure called Padmasambhava, who a lot of Tibetans regard as a Buddha. And he took Buddhism to Tibet, and the yana that followed is known as the Vajrayana, the third yana vehicle. Vajra meaning thunderbolt. And in, this is interesting, the main hallmark of this practice is known as Tantra, which in turn is all about energy. Energy. The transformation of energy for the good. So, if you think of all our emotions, as we've defined them already, as being energy latched onto something, you think of the energy in anger or rage, in sex drive, in all sorts of things. That is potential energy for the good, if you can, so to speak, liberate it from its trapped sense and direct it. And so this third yana is about that. And we have practices. In Buddhism, there are visualizations of beings of higher gods, if you like, the small g. In yoga, what do we have? Anything of this ilk? We're back to our subtle body in our yoga mode now, where we have these energy, concentrated energy centers, which, according to this Dr. Motayama, in each chakra are our samskaras. Our samskaras, that's a word for products of past karma that have sort of, if you like, coalesced into this deep emotion, that deep emotion, this characteristic, that tendency, that make us at the deepest level what we are. According to Dr. Motayama, they are spread, according to the nature of the particular samskara, into all of these chakras. How are we going to get them out to have a look at them? Are we talking about Buddhism or are we talking about yoga here? How are we going to realise them? How are we going to transform them? Well, certainly chakra meditation is precisely about that. And Sarah Powers says, yes, there are a couple of chakra meditations you can do just to raise your awareness, but to go any further, you've got to be with a skilled teacher to guide you. So you're really dealing with some deep stuff then. Mm. But there are some basic practices we can do just to sort of get in touch with that propensity, that potentiality, if you like.
Well, some scar is necessarily a negative thing.
No.
They're just characteristics.
The bright person that you are is a samskara, if you like, or likely to be. And don't forget, it's not all previous life stuff, it's what you create this time around, very much so, it's ongoing. Mm. You know, if you kill somebody in your 20s, you've got that deep-set samskara in you of this lifetime, if you like. Mm. If that was a willed action, and you meant it, then it's a karma-forming thing which will produce samskaras. They sometimes talk about a fourth yana. This one. Buddhism came to the West. When did yoga come to the West? There was a marvelous little bit of film of an event in Chicago in 1893. It was a bigger world then. People in India did things that people in the West never even heard of. So in 1893, they held a festival of world religions. And over from India came a man called Swami Vivekananda. And he gave a talk, and because he was such an eloquent speaker, and because he was so strange to Westerners, they were absolutely bowled over with him. He was a hero from the first word almost, having really just woken people up to the existence of yoga. And from that day on, everyone wanted to do yoga. It really did have a big impact. And so slowly, through the beginnings of the 20th century, various teachers would come, yoga coming to the West, but it didn't really mushroom, you're right, until the 60s, when a famous Western musician took up Iyengar yoga. Iyengar, B-K-S Iyengar, and found it was absolutely necessary to keep him in good condition during his world touring. And that Westerner was Yehudi Menuhin. And if you look at the classic book Light on Yoga, Yehudi Menuhin writes the introduction to it. And he invited Iyengar over, and gradually more people came over, and one thing led to another, and it's really stuck, although I think it's been in interesting phases. Yoga has developed, and you could say that Buddhism has developed too, Western Buddhism. It's the next evolution, Buddhism coming to the West and finding another form, which it has. So I think even Sangharakshita has talked about it as a potential fourth yana, another vehicle, because it doesn't really, it's taking the other three, as they each did in turn, and developing into a fourth, incorporating the original three. So, out of those three yanas, we've got three different sets of practices. And I think certainly in the latter one, with our chakra meditations, we've got a very compatible one with the practices of the Vajrayana. That's what this guy says, certainly. He's saying that the Tantra is the Vajrayana, which is, it's been thought about as separate in, perhaps Tantra was more of a yogic phrase, I don't know, but it's clearly centrally Buddhist there. It's established in the West as part of the body of practice that we yogi stroke Buddhists do. It's just there. So I thought next we might go upstairs. We've got an hour and 8 minutes left to do 5 hours worth of practice. So apart from any questions here, we'd better go up and do it, don't we?